So the opinion 491 closes with what appears to be somewhat of a safe harbor about a lawyer's reasonable evaluation after inquiry and based upon information reasonably available at the time does not violate the rules. And this is where I'm going to pitch it to you, Kelly, and ask you, when you've got a situation where you have, some lingering concerns, how much do you lean on your outside counsel to help you with that and to give you this kind of reasonable evaluation to help protect you from an in-house standpoint?
You know, that's a good question. And, again, I do think a lot of it is going to depend on the savviness and sophistication of your in-house counsel. So I think most in-house counsel are going to tell you that they view their outside counsel as a partner with them, a partner in the business. And so, depending on the situation, it may be going to the outside counsel and explaining what you've seen and, why you have lingering concerns, and either getting yourself comfortable with the way the outside counsel is viewing it, or if they also have lingering concerns or need to look at a little bit more, then you go in arm in arm to report it up the chain to make sure that you're protecting the company and that you're doing what you need to do to make that reasonable inquiry, and that you also, from a lawyer's perspective, are protecting yourself. And so, some of it's going to depend on how much pushback you're getting and things like that, too. I mean, haven't seen that, at KC, look into everything and make sure that we're operating exactly as we should. But certainly in private practice, had that experience where, things needed to be looked at further. And sometimes you have to help the in-house counsel see what that is. And also it's building up that credibility and that rapport so it's coming at them from the place of true concern and protection of the company versus we're outside counsel and we want to run up a bunch more fees. So we need to look at everything under the sun to make sure you don't have problems in these other areas. So it's really a delicate balance, but I would view it as that partnership with your in-house counsel and outside counsel that you're going in together and making those calls. And then you can help figure out the dynamics of how and when you raise that.
And when Kelly was talking about credibility, I mean, as the defense lawyer, the outside lawyer, when you're brought into these matters, you really have to, if you have a long-term relationship with the client, obviously, that helps. You come loaded with some credibility with that client when you say, we really need to take these steps, at this stage, And if we run into more problems, we may have to do more, but this is at least a minimum or what we need to do, because ultimately you've got to have credibility with the SEC or the DOJ on the other side, and they've got to trust you enough that you've done your due diligence, you've done your homework, and when you talk to them, you're not like reading the statement and backing away from the statement, but you actually have kicked the tires, looked under the hood, and if you're going to make a disclosure, this is what you found.
I'll add, one thing that scares me about this opinion is in the context of when you're giving advice in a more compliance role. I've had clients call and ask me whether a particular transaction would violate U.S. sanction or export control laws. And then you talk through it with them. And at the end of the day, some of this stuff is a little bit murky, right? Because it's not, it's not as clear because of the parties that you're doing business with. And then going to, Kelly and Paul's point about giving advice on an area that's not settled. And what bothers me about this opinion, and I'm not sure there's anything we do about it, it's just something we need to be aware of, is when you're giving advice on maybe an aggressive position or a position that's not clear cut, where is somebody going to draw the line later and say that you were willfully blind or even culpable in that? And so, I think the best you can do, what I've tried to do is, in those situations, at least put something in writing and make it abundantly clear that we're not giving an opinion about whether it violates the law and that there's a lot of risk associated and here are the red flags associated with it and just kind of hear the facts, right?
Well, you know, and really to amplify what Matthew said, I mean, I think back in the 1990s, I started the first healthcare fraud task force in the Northern District of Texas. I think it was the first one in Texas. And the line between what's regulatory and civil and between what's civil and criminal is such a fine line. Could I sit here and say we got it right every time? I'm sure we didn't, you know, because there's a lot of trial and error, you know, and a lot of judgment goes into how that gets sliced. And right now, you know, I'm seeing the exact same thing out of the antitrust division in D.C. They're getting treating criminally what would have been treated civilly, you know, last year. I mean, I'm in two cases now that are first of their kind ever filed as criminal per se cases in the country.